Good evening. This is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Lyanda Lynn Haupt, writer, naturalist, and eco-philosopher. And we're talking about her latest book, Rooted: Life at the Crossroads of Science, Nature, and Spirit. Lyanda, it's a pleasure to talk to you again. Welcome back to the show.
I'm so happy to be here, Mark. Thank you for having me.
Talk to me about Frog Church, because that's the church I want to go to.
It's funny you should say that. You know, this book, the title of my new book is Rooted, but up until basically the last minute, the working title was Frog Church.
I would have totally dug that. I thought that would have been fantastic.
My publisher just finally said, you know, it's just too weird.
No, it's not. And not only that, I think it gets to the essence of what the book is about, too.
Thank you. I'm glad you're calling that out. So Frog Church makes an appearance in the book. It is the title of the what I call an invocation rather than an introduction. And so when I was young, I was raised Catholic. And I want listeners to know that this book is not about religion. It's not pro-religion. It's not against religion.
It is spiritual, though.
It is spiritual, and I use that. I just want to say, if people are religious or not religious, don't worry.
Right, right. I'm definitely not religious, and I totally, thoroughly enjoyed the book.
Thank you. So I use the word spirit quite expansively to talk about those aspects of our complex human intelligence that are not measurable in the usual way: our creativity, our imagination, our sense of the sacred, our sense of interconnection. So that's what I'm talking about. So, but back to the frogs.
Frog Church. It's Frog Church.
So I was raised Catholic, and I had these crazy saints wandering through my life with my, you know, education in catechism, saints that spoke with wolves, who spoke with birds, who lived in caves, who baked breads in clay ovens, who were rescued by ravens, and
it's like the best saints.
And I just thought, wow, anything is possible in the way that we relate to the natural world.
Right.
And this was my takeaway as a kid raised Catholic. I wasn't in a family that emphasized guilt or any of that. And so with that, as part of my inspiration, my childhood home was on the edge of a canyon. And it was a suburban neighborhood, but it backed a canyon, and the bottom of the canyon was a creek. And that is where I'm a card-carrying introvert. I always have been since a child. So that is where I found my sanctuary. I take my notebook, take my apple, and go down there and by the creek where there were a lot of frogs. And I learned that if I would lie still, I could just scoop the frogs up very carefully and place them on my belly. If I held really still, they would stay. And overhead, you know, the trees were whispering and clouds were flowing. And I just thought, this is church to me.
Yep.
It seemed just the same as what the saints I was learning about were after. And so I really named it Frog Church, and that's how the book starts.
I think the funniest part is when you go to the confessional and talk about Frog Church. I can only imagine that moment. I'd love to have been in that confession booth to hear and to actually watch the priest who took that confession. This book,
Father Sondergeld.
Now
you're not know what to say.
And I want to let the audience know, you make some fascinating references throughout the book to an extended Catholic knowledge, but also Buddhist, Taoist. I mean, you make a lot of spiritual connections. However, you also make a lot of scientific connections. And that's the point of this book, is to bring science, spirit, and nature together and sort of learn how to walk in the natural world again, in tune with it. Is that safe to say?
Absolutely, yes. And it was important to me to bring those things together. I think some of the subjects that I'm talking about in certain contexts could wander off into New Age or whatever, and I wanted to keep them very grounded in I wanted to ground all of the aspects of our human intelligence. And so finding good science was very important to
me. Right.
But I also wanted to acknowledge that what a lot of this science is doing, the science that is showing how the health of our minds and our bodies is improved when we spend time in nature, that although it's beautiful that it's showing us the specifics of the physiological response, you know, that responses are located in our prefrontal cortex and activate the parasympathetic nervous system and the very specific ways that that happens, that's beautiful and that's new. But in terms of saying, hey, we feel better and at home when we go into nature, that's not a discovery. That is innate human knowledge. That is something that poets and mystics and indigenous cultures and children across time and space have spoken in many different and beautiful ways.
Although, I would say that in recent decades, children have not been as attuned to being in the natural world as when I was a child.
And
when I was a child, I grew up on the banks of the Charles River and collected frogs and snapping turtles and loved everything and was fascinated by everything that I saw. I've taught young people's classes and taken them on hikes, and I was astounded about how many kids had never seen a frog.
And
that's part of the reason this book exists, is to sort of correct that deficit.
It really is an invitation for us to remember that innate knowing, remember that at-homeness and connection with the natural world, and to explore that in our own ways. And, you know, the technological intrusion, I know that everyone is talking about this, but the intrusion of technology into our lives has wreaked havoc with our attention spans. And we see that in kids. I don't know, my sister's a teacher, and you may have friends that are teachers. They talk a lot about how the kids can't write papers that are as long as they used to be able to. And so I think we need to really be mindful of that going forward for both the health of our own minds and those of the children and young people in our care.
It's just, your book is about learning to enjoy the experience of being out of doors. And you make it very clear, some of these things, you don't have to go to some state park or remote forest. It can just be outside in an urban environment. There's a lot of aspects of what you talk about, which are, no matter where you live, you can experience that.
I hope so, yes. I kind of wanted to thank you, Mark, for recognizing that. It's important that I want to do two things at once. I want to say yes. When we step out the door, we just even lean our head out the window, we are experiencing, you know, weather and sky and the cycles of the sun and moon. And we can see probably anywhere we look, we can at least see a weed that is rooted in soil. And so we are partaking of all of that at all times, and just shift in awareness to notice it. But I hope I can also invite people to press themselves to wander a little farther into the world and maybe experience some wild places that are pushing the boundaries of our comfort levels a little bit, because the forest is not always an easy place. It's nuanced. And when I say forest and wildness, I'm speaking, you know, also about deserts and beaches, and just using that to kind of encompass any wilder place. So the invitation is to maybe push our comfort level a little bit and experience some of that nuance, that things aren't always perfectly safe or flat or even calm, you know? And all of that informs the fullness of our intelligence.
For me, it means that you recognize what we're losing and why it's important that we keep as much as we can. And what the real dangers of global climate change are, and some of the larger ecological issues. You can't understand why that stuff is important unless you feel for it. And as soon as you get a feeling for it, you've got a stake in the action and vote accordingly.
Exactly. And people, there's that maxim that we love what we know.
That's right? Exactly right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk about some of your chapters. Because some of them just made me roll on the floor. and that's not a pretty sight. I want to talk about earthing, about walking barefoot.
Okay.
Some people hear that and they go, you got to be kidding me. I'm putting on, like, when I go into the forest, I'm putting on these boots that are, you know, covering up my ankles. There's no way in God's green earth I am going to be walking barefoot. But why is it such a different experience?
Okay, first I want to say that I am not talking about leaving our shoes behind when we're carrying a backpack up a trail. We need to protect our feet. I'm not talking about hopping on the bus and going downtown to work, you know, without your shoes on at all.
Ooh, no, that could be very bad.
No, let's not do that. but I am talking about that experience of kind of shedding.
Right.
For time, for minutes, you know, for 5 minutes, for 30 seconds, shedding the layer that keeps us from direct contact with the earth, even if it's just concrete. And that's made of elemental things. And when we do that, a lot of things happen. If we're mindful about it. I mean, for one thing, I don't want to get too heavy. It's spring now, and the grass is green where I am, and the sun is out some days, and it just feels good to kick off your shoes and put them on earth or in the sand. And that brings us joy. And that's good enough in my book. But it also, if we want to get philosophical about it, it's a kind of casting off of something that's a layer of separation. So it takes going barefoot sometimes removes our sense of pretense, of elevation, of separateness from the earth. And so I think when we have that direct contact for even a few minutes at a time, it can be very enlivening. And the other thing is it's just good for us physiologically.
Right.
So I talk about earthing in the book, and there's that there's a cohort who's trying to prove the science of earthing by saying that our bodies have a mainly positive ionic charge, and the earth has a mainly negative ionic charge. And when we walk barefoot, that brings that into balance.
Mm-hmm.
And I have to tell you, Mark, I am a barefoot wanderer, and I wanted that to be true so bad.
Let me tell you what I think about it. And when you take off your shoes in the forest, you're sensing things from the opposite end of your body than you normally sense them. Because normally you see, smell, and you might hear things. But your soles of your feet are incredibly sensitive, as anybody who's stepped on a Lego piece can tell you. And when you start walking through like a mossy forest or in wet leaves or in bare ground, it's incredible what you start sensing from the opposite end of your body.
You know, it's so funny. I wrote all this and I didn't really think about that opposite end, out of your head.
That's right. You're out of your head.
I do want to say that I couldn't, reading all the papers and all the stuff about earthing, I couldn't make that scientific connection work. So that's not there yet for me. That piece isn't holding up quite. But like you say, we have all of these nerve endings on the bottom of our feet. And we also know a different angle of science, biomechanists who study the health of our bodies and the way that we move have found that when we spend even a little time walking barefoot, we move with more grace, with more ease. We have all these little muscles and tendons and bones in our feet that never get moved because they're so constantly overprotected. So walking barefoot allows us to inhabit the fullness of possibility in our bodies. And that's beautiful, I think.
The other thing is, around here, at least in New England, it's daring. Because we have like 6 tick-borne diseases, and so everybody's very tick, and I've had onset of Lyme several times, and so just the act of taking off your shoes and walking around, and obviously check for ticks afterwards, and don't be a dummy about it, but it's like actually a daring thing to do.
And being daring is really fun sometimes.
You make that pretty clear in the book. You make that clear. Now, where were you walking? This is in a different chapter, where all the rattlesnakes were.
Oh, right.
I happen to love rattlesnakes.
I love rattlesnakes, too.
There was a butt there.
In you or for you?
In you. You have frogs. I love snakes. I'm a snake person. So the idea that there'd be rattlesnakes there, I would be spending all my time just watching rattlesnakes.
I want to love rattlesnakes, but
come on.
I do. I think
they
really
warn you. They warn you before they're going to hit. They rattle. What more could you ask? I mean, mosquitoes don't do that. You got an actual creature that's going like, hey, listen, get out of the way. So,
and it's a beautiful rhythmic sound.
Isn't it?
But it was the sheer number, Mark, that got me.
See, that would make me, that would just be my perfect day.
Okay, well, you need to visit.
I've visited the West, and every time I go to the West, I see lots of rattlesnakes. And the two species of venomous pit vipers we have here are endangered, so I've yet to see one, even though I look at them. But I'm happy enough with the regular snakes that we have. But I love rattlesnakes. I think they get a bad rap.
I think so too. And one of the things I wrote in the book is that, I mean, I almost stepped on one, and I thought, okay, whoa. It made me really awake, and it made me really careful. And I thought, but it also made me feel alive and brisk. And I thought, this is the calculus of the wild, where this snake doesn't want to bite me any more than I want to be bitten, you know?
That's right. So, that's absolutely right.
So that was, enlivening is the word I want to keep for that.
I want to talk about wandering.
Okay.
A lot of people, and I love that chapter and the way you describe about wandering, even in an urban environment, and finding new corners of the city that you live in, and you might find some new restaurant or some new shop that you've never seen before. But in the wild, obviously within reason, and don't do something stupid, but wandering can be really, without a plan, can be absolutely amazing to do.
And it's something that modern humans don't do.
Well, you're warned against it since you're like a little kid.
Right. We are warned. Don't wander off.
Right. That's exactly it.
It will happen. The wolf will get you. I tie this chapter into some really fascinating research by John O'Keefe, who in 2014 won the Nobel Prize in Medicine for discovering actual location grid neurons located in the human hippocampus. And ties this, he says that the functioning of these location neurons are intertwined with the way that our memory functions. So there's a sense in which we are wired to gain knowledge by locating ourselves in space. And yet, in modern times, we have very little opportunity to do that. We have Siri telling us where to go. We have roads that are laid out in these grid patterns that we don't veer from. And even when we go into the mountains, we have a trail that just says, this way, this way, this way, or you're going to get lost. And so what I want to advocate is that, you know, again, safely, don't wander off in the woods if you don't have a map and compass and don't know how to use them and don't know how to get back. But we can go out our door or go to the park or
take a trail that's not labeled.
Take a trail that's not labeled and not have a plan. Just kind of go, I'm going to go where the spirit moves me, you know, and ideally maybe not have a time that you have to be back for dinner and not have a set route and see what happens. And something will happen.
You'll literally, anytime I've taken it, first of all, I'm on a trail, so I know it can always back up.
Yep.
But I'm on a trail that I've not read about, that nobody's told me about, that I've never been on before. I always find something that's interesting. It can just be a view. It can be something alive. It can be just some rocks or something different. But there's always something, even just the lay of the land. There's always something new to see, and you'll always remember that trail.
Right. And I love how the science grounds that. Like you said, you're wandering, your location grid neurons are firing, they're learning things, and then it becomes entwined with your memory.
You start reading I find myself reading the landscape. Like, obviously, there's going to be a stream down at the bottom of the hill here. And you get really, your mind does get very active looking at the landscape, being in the landscape.
Right. It's fun with all these hiking guides and trail guides that are online now. You can read every little thing about any trail that you're going to take. And it's kind of fun, as you say, to just go out and read, oh, this bank is really mossy. That means it's facing, you know, north. Or I see a certain kind of light over there. That invites me to believe that there's a body of water over the next hill. Or you know, all of these things that we, I just want to invite us to experience our innate ways of learning and knowing.
You're listening to WISN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. My guest tonight is Lyanda Lynn Hupt, writer, naturalist, and eco-philosopher. And we're talking about the latest book. This is one of those books. It's really, summer's almost here. This is a perfect book to read at that time because you can try out a lot of this stuff. Rooted, Life at the Crossroads of Science, Nature, and Spirit. Lyanda, one of the most, they're all important chapters, but one just really struck home to me, and that was one about alone, about being alone. Mm-hmm. And the fact that we've developed a culture of unsolitude. Even if you're by yourself in your room, you're on the internet connected to somebody.
Yeah.
And especially for women, you're told never to hike alone. And there are a lot of horror stories that have happened. Bad things have happened. But then you put those statistics in perspective, and things aren't that common. But you yourself, when you've camped out overnight, have felt a tremendous tension camping out by yourself.
Mm-hmm. I was really surprised. I believe in our culture, solitude is really rare. And almost every culture across time and space has had a structured way for people to find, that sounds sort of weird to say, a structured way to find solitude, but quests were valued. Times in the desert and wilderness were valued. And I don't want to the way different cultures come to that idea are all very unique. So I don't want to speak, you know, for
sure.
Say that there's just one way of doing that, but time alone and the awareness that that would not necessarily be easy has been a value across time and across cultures. And we don't have that in the dominant modern culture where, you know, you and I and most of your listeners are coming from. And so I think creating those times are very important. And one of the things that I found out in researching this book was in talking to other women who hike alone sometimes. And we all had the same experience. I thought it was just me. I thought I was just kind of afraid of the dark and I needed to get over it. And, you know, the dark really isn't, nothing bad is going on in there. That isn't going on in the daytime. So I talked to other women, solo hikers, and everyone had the same experience. So we freak out at night and then in the morning wake up and go, oh my gosh, this place is so beautiful. What was wrong with me? And so I really think that just knowing that discomfort is, or even anxiety is part of the equation, and it's something that we pass through, and it's something that we can embrace, and it honors the complexity of both ourselves and the natural world and our place in the natural world, and so we can. Be uncomfortable and recognize that, but not fear that.
Right, and I think it's sort of almost an innate reaction right now, to even male or female, to be tense, especially as it gets dark. And if you're out in the forest, there's all these noises that you're not familiar with, and your mind runs amok. And that's part of the thing, is to become aware of that process, as you point out in the book. And then try to work to calm it down. But even during the day, walking alone on a trail for extended period of times, it's an incredible, wonderful experience that you can just stop whenever you want and look at things. And you're being alone in the forest is one of my most cherished experiences.
And it's one that I want to simultaneously say that, yeah, we need to have common sense and we need to be prepared and we need to be safe. But that walking alone is not innately not safe. And as you say, there is nothing like walking alone in a forest is a rare and beautiful experience. And I hope that we can invite people to give it a try.
Yeah, people seem to be everywhere. So any moment I'm on a trail for an extended period of time in a forest alone is just a precious experience. It's like really special. Now, there's so much more in this book, and I want to encourage people to read it. But you get to the end, you get to death and a natural death. And I just sort of broke up totally when I read your list that you sent to your poor husband. Now, we only have 2 minutes left, and we can't possibly talk about the entire list. But I love that list. You asked him not to unplug you right away, to take his time. You asked him to binge watch Buffy the Vampire Slayer. Not a bad choice, by the way.
There's seven seasons. That will give me.
I know. I binge watched it. And I thought that whole list was just so cool. I thought that list was amazing. And good for your husband for putting up with you, by the way.
I agree. Kudos to my husband.
I just want to end. It ends number four. For burial, I'd like to be wearing a hand-sewn organic cotton or linen dress. Something simple, not flowery.
Yeah, that's the one that sent him over the edge. He was doing okay. And then just the look on his face was... And so I said, don't, and I realized, oh, of course, my poor grieving husband, he's already dealing with Buffy the Vampire Slayer and his wife is dead. And now he has to get a dress.
I know. He's got this entire checklist and it's going to take him many hours to get through this checklist. And in the meantime, he's grieving over the loss of you.
I hope he's grieving. But so I said, don't worry, honey. I'll make the dress. And I'm making the dress.
I need a photograph of that. I need to see this dress. I need to see this dress. I want to see it.
I will send you a photograph of the dress. Yeah.
That would be perfect. We are completely out of time, and we barely scratched the surface of the book. Again, I want to emphasize to the audience, this is a book to pick up now and to sort of read through the summer. And you can literally try out things as you go from chapter to chapter. It's that kind of a book. My guest tonight has been Lyanda Lynn Hupt, writer, naturalist, and eco-philosopher, and we've been talking about her latest book. It's really a wonderful read, and it is a philosophy book too, but it's also got things that you can try. Rooted, Life at the Crossroads of Science, Nature, and Spirit. Lyanda, it's been a pleasure.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It was a delight.
You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch. Good night.